Rivers, lakes, marshes, and bogs. What do they have in common? Well, they're wet and home to lots of incredible species. Today, we're joined by Dr. Luke Jacobus, a professor and researcher at Indiana University Columbus, who has a fascination with freshwater insects and ecosystems. I'm Moni Boehm.
And I'm Justin Burkhoff. Welcome to the Protect Species podcast, where we celebrate biodiversity and converse with conservationists. Welcome, Luke. Can you start briefly by telling us and our listeners who you are and a little bit about what you do?
I just told them who he is.
I mean, that's true.
But maybe a little bit more, right?
Sure. My name is Luke Jacobus. I'm a professor of biology at Indiana University Columbus. I do research on aquatic insects and especially mayflies. And in my role as a professor, I teach and I do lots of outreach with the community, both locally and even globally, like we're doing here today.
Excellent. So, you know, there's this passion for wetlands, and you mentioned a little bit about what your, you know, your study focuses is. Where did this start? Where did you fall in love with freshwater systems?
I don't know that anything like that happens at any one point in time. I think it's something that happens over a lifetime. And I grew up in a rural area and had to make my own entertainment. And a lot of that was being outdoors and walking around and seeing lots of interesting things close up and far away. And as time's gone on, I've seen that some of those things that I love are being challenged by some of the things that people do. And I really want to hang on to some of those things and be able to share those things with my daughter and for them to be there for future generations too.
Awesome. So you mentioned already, or maybe Justin did, that mayflies are your current focus. Can you tell us a little bit more about mayflies?
Yeah.
Including explaining the word that I can never really say when I'm slightly tired.
Go for it. Well, let's
hear
it.
I cannot do it.
Ephemeral.
I have trouble speaking today.
Our producer put the word ephemeral in the notes. So how does that apply to mayflies and what does it mean to you?
Thanks for helping me, Justin.
Mayflies belong to the insect order Ephemeroptera. That's the scientific name for all mayflies. And when you break down that word, you get ephemer and optera. Ephemeral wing, short-lived wing. Mayfly adults live for a very short period of time, sometimes a few minutes to a few hours, at most a couple of days. And when something is ephemeral, it's short-lived. It's only here for a little while. And that's where the mayflies get their scientific name.
Oh, excellent.
And how do you study them if they're only here for a very short time?
You have to have really good timing.
Excellent.
Really good timing.
This is why I do not study mayflies.
Really good timing if you want to find the winged stages, the stages that are flying around or out perched on vegetation on land. Fortunately, the nymphal stages, the stages that are the young that look different from those winged adults, live in water, and their lifespan is a lot longer in many cases, sometimes several weeks to even a couple of years. And so if you know where to go look and know their exact address, so to speak, within that place, you can find the nymphal stages. And those are sometimes easier to find, sometimes not.
How do you find the exact address of a mayfly?
Google it. No.
Google it.
No.
And phone book.
That's something that comes with experience and being out in nature and getting muddy and dirty and awfully wet and splashing around in wetlands and streams and lakes and ponds. And you find mayflies living in specific places. And each species tends to have its own ecological niche, its own little space in nature that it fills, its own role that it fills, certain things that it does in certain places at certain times. And as you gain experience with the different kinds of mayflies, you learn where to find them, when to find them, and how to look for them.
So it's the growth of your experience and expertise allows for this kind of reoccurring experience or like a longitudinal study where you're visiting the same sites over and over again?
Yeah, that's very true. Or even places I haven't been before, I can go in and look at the habitats and say, hey, that's where I'm going to find a certain kind of mayfly.
Okay.
As an example of this, last summer I had a scientist from Columbia visiting me here in Indiana, and we went out collecting together. And she studies a certain genus of mayflies, Trichorhythodes. And we went to this stream that she obviously had never been to before. She'd mm-hmm. never done field work in North America, and certainly not in Indiana. We walk into this stream, and within a few minutes, she had gone and found Trichorhythodes mayflies.
That's phenomenal.
And so that's the sort of thing with experience and with a trained eye that you can go do. But they have to be there for you to find them.
Okay. And we'll dive a little bit more into some of your research.
Dive, I like it.
Yes. Good puns.
Yeah.
A little bit about that a little bit later. But, you know, you mentioned that you're a professor of biology. So how did you, you know, how did you wander into that part of the world? And what about it do you love the most?
I like being able to do something different every day. I like being able to delve beneath the surface, to continue our water puns.
Excellent.
Here, and to really engage people in some of those things that I've found, and to share some of my passion for this wonderful world around us, and to provide people like me with some background and education about that world. I teach at a small commuter campus in South Central Indiana, and it's actually the area where I grew up. I certainly mm-hmm. didn't plan on that happening. and as a matter of fact, when I was at that stage of life, I wanted to get as far away from there as I could. But I found myself back there, and I'm glad I'm back there. And it's a chance to give back to that community who helped me get a start, and share with some of the people there some of the things that I've learned from getting away for a while. And that I'm now learning right there about this wonderful world around us. And that really invigorates me to be able to help ordinary people and people that I identify with and that I understand and that were a lot like me when I was growing up, mm-hmm. to give them opportunities for learning about some of the same things that I had a chance at.
So, I mean, I feel I know the answer to this already because we've just been listening to you. And frankly, just listening to you is very inspiring, listening to your story. How are you inspiring this freshwater love in your students or in the community that you work with?
We get outdoors.
Excellent.
Excellent.
4 weeks out of my ecology lab class are spent at a national wildlife refuge. And we spend about 4 hours a day there getting muddy and dirty, and getting in the water and looking for all kinds of living things, not just mayflies. They put up with me droning on about mayflies. But as mayflies are diverse, I try to keep my topics diverse and help them learn more about the natural systems around us, not just mayflies, not just water, but land and air, and how land and air and water all interact to support all of life and to keep this world going.
I mean, that's fantastic. I think back to my own undergrad experience, and the classes that stick out most were the ones that had that hands-on field component. And mine was on the beaches of California, which sounds really glamorous, but it's way less glamorous in February. It's very wet. It's very cold. But those I know,
poor little Justin.
But those sorts of experiences, I think, really do, you know, open up opportunities and allow people to kind of explore and project themselves into this sort of career path. So it's great to hear that it's something that's worked for you when you were, you know, coming up, and that you're imparting on your students now.
Learn by doing. Immersive learning.
Excellent. Immersive in fresh water.
Immersive. There we go again.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of which, well, I happen to like, you know, wetlands and other freshwater ecosystems too,
just
which is just as well, given my job title.
Yes.
Otherwise, I would be in the wrong job. So I've obviously only recently moved to Indiana, but as far as I hear, Indiana was once home to one of the nation's largest wetlands. Can you explain what happened to Beaver Lake, great name, by the way, and the Kankakee River?
Well, Northwest Indiana was about half covered with water for 6 months or more out of the year prior to European settlement. And when Europeans came in, I'm speaking of that because that's my lineage here. We tended to try to shape the landscape to suit our immediate needs. And what we did is we drained water so that we could put plants in the ground that we wanted to use. And Beaver Lake was a casualty of that process. It was a huge lake, probably between 40 and 50 square miles in size in the early 1800s. And after the drainage activities got underway in the late 1800s, by about 1917, Beaver Lake was down to about a third of its size. And then by the 1960s, it was gone entirely. And you can, if you look at a map, you can see some of that history. There's a place called Lake Village, and there's no lake around. Mm. And that's where that village got its name. It was named for the lake that once was nearby. There was another lake that was 12 miles long up in that area of Indiana, and it's all but gone now, too. It was part of the Kankakee River basin. The Kankakee River was a river that was once very slow and windy and moved through wetlands in that part of the state. And again, in our wisdom to help the river be more efficient and help the river do its job more. Hear the dripping sarcasm.
That sounds terribly German, and I do apologize.
we
must be more efficient.
Yes, dredged and straightened said river, and tiled and drained the wetlands so that we could use them and live on them, and customize them for our purposes. And in the meantime, those wetland habitats are gone. Many of the creatures and plants that once called them home aren't there anymore. And it's a very different landscape than what we would have seen 200 years ago in that area.
So even with all this human intervention into it and changing it, you know, what are the kind of unique parts of the Indiana freshwater ecosystems that we still see today?
You can see little relics of places as you travel through all of Indiana, little bits of what once was. And in northern Indiana, there's still a few of the natural lakes left and occasional little pockets of habitat along the road. Sometimes along railroads, you can see remnants of what once was because the railroads went through relatively early, mm-hmm. and some of those habitats haven't been altered or messed with quite as much. And sometimes old cemeteries offer chances of seeing some of the plants that were there when they were founded in the middle part of the 1800s. A lot of those are prairie plants, but okay. Some of them are wetland plants too, because people like to put cemeteries at tops of hills or on the sides of hills near streams because it was beautiful. And so you can find some of those things in spaces such as that. There are a few protected areas here and there across the Indiana landscape where there were some of the original habitats that we've since recognized as important and have kind of cordoned them off and saved them so that Hoosiers can experience them and see them and so that they can be protected for the other kinds of non-human life that call it home.
So I suppose the story that you've just told about Beaver Lake and Kankakee River, it's not really entirely unique to Indiana, may no. I say. That's happened really around the world. So I'm from Germany, which is why I'm allowed to joke about it, just as a disclaimer, in case it wasn't already blatantly obvious. But obviously the same stuff has happened in Germany too, making rivers more efficient, making them work for us. Why are wetlands so important at a global level? Why is wetland conservation so important at a global level, given what we've already done to these systems?
I think first and foremost, there's a great diversity of life. There's many different kinds of things that live in wetlands, that call them home and don't have any other place to live because that's their space. That's where they live. That's what they do. even if we set that aside, and sometimes we have to do that because we do have to think about ourselves as well and consider what the wetland habitats do for us, that gets into an area that we've labeled ecosystem services. Mm-hmm. Ecosystems serve us. They do lots of things that if it didn't happen, we'd all die. It sounds...
Not to put too fine a point on it.
And on that note, that was this week's episode of the Protect Species podcast.
Yeah, the ecosystems help us in many ways. They give us our clean air to breathe. Mm-hmm. They give us our clean water to drink. They provide us with processing of the nastiness that we put out into the world. Wetlands in particular do a fantabulous, there's a scientific word for
excellent.
You. They do an amazing job of cleaning up water for underground water reserves, for having clean water in rivers, for having clean water available to us to use. They help to mitigate flooding events. One of the reasons that we have some of the catastrophic floods that we have now is because we have gotten rid of the wetlands. Wetlands hold water.
All the floodplains.
Yeah, they hold water, and when there's nothing there to hold the water, it has to go someplace, which is downstream. And if you've taken all the curves out of it and shortened really the quickly. Distance...
it does it efficiently.
It does it very efficiently.
Absolutely. Or where I lived before, if you then also build houses on the floodplain.
Yeah, also not great.
Brilliant.
Because it's
great
beautiful.
Idea. It's got a water view, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Prime estate.
The Riverview Shopping District is going to get underwater very quickly.
It's like living in Venice.
And so the wetlands help to sort of modulate or keep the water levels in reasonable ranges. Another thing that wetlands do is they hold back a lot of the organic carbon that is out in nature and slow the carbon cycling down in a good way.
Yeah,
that they are wonderful reserves for that carbon. And as we hear a lot of talk about carbon sequestration, wetlands are an incredible natural way of doing that.
Yeah.
I could go on and on.
Totally, because they
limited.
Do a lot.
Yes, they do lots of things.
One thing that's interesting, you talked about like water filtration, and you know the almighty algorithm of my Instagram keeps on showing me these videos of people using like small wetland systems in their backyards for freshwater pools. So to reduce the amount of chemicals we're putting into it. So, you know, even at this micro level, we're starting to see the values of it, but at the same time, it's still not being necessarily put into practice in larger ecosystem spaces. We're starting
to have a very niche Instagram.
I do. It's weird. The algorithm provides, as it were. So when we talk about, you know, how protecting wetlands is really important, how do we support the wetlands that we still have, and what are avenues to allow that coexistence moving forward? When we look at, you know, you mentioned ecosystem services, and you know, we live in a big agricultural state, you know, how do we make sure that those two things can coexist and don't come into conflict with each other?
Well, they have to coexist, because as long as there are humans, we'll have agriculture to support humans, and we need natural systems to help even support our agriculture and help protect the soil that we use to grow things in. If we don't try to hold some of that soil in place using plants, it washes away. And if you lose your topsoil, you lose your most productive agricultural land. And so one way to both help protect wetlands and to help protect agriculture in the long term is to have filter strips that have vegetation in them near and long waterways, so that any soil that might be coming off of a field gets trapped there. The plants take up some of the excess nutrients that might be added to help keep our agricultural systems going and stop them right there. your question was multifaceted.
It was.
And so
they're more fun that way.
But yeah, they are more fun that way. And it is a good way to get your guests to start rambling and to start thinking about lots of different things. But I do want to answer your question. So if you could track back, if you're able, and put you on the spot now.
The second part of it was, how do we allow these systems to coexist and support the rehabilitation of some of those wetland systems that we've removed from the environment?
I think that was the direction I was going a bit with some of that answer, is to find ways that protecting environmental systems supports agriculture, and also helping people engaged in that profession to see the value of the wetlands that are right alongside the land that they're stewards of, the lands that they're the temporary caretakers of. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in a farming community. I come from many generations of farmers. Farmers want to protect their land. That's their income now and hopefully for future generations. And so as these different groups work together, I think more and more common ground can be found. There's a really good project my brain's going blank at the moment. The Little Pine Creek, I think it is, up in northwest Indiana, south of Lafayette, where they've engaged the local community to help protect the stream and all the land that supports that stream. And a lot of the local farmers are really buying into the idea, engaging in no-till practices, mm-hmm. Ways of disturbing the ground less. And ultimately, a lot of these things not only prevent erosion, but they keep a lot of the nutrients right there in the soil. One of the reasons that we have to add nutrients to the soil is because we take them away when we harvest. And if we take or allow some of the byproducts from the agricultural process to disappear, get washed away, blown away, whatever. And as long as you keep those things right there local, they can be cycled through and really cut down on some of those inputs. And that saves money.
Yeah.
Yep. And that's something that I think everyone can agree on.
Saving money. Sure.
Saving money is good. I need to get better at it.
This podcast is a production of the Global Center for Species Survival at the Indianapolis Zoo. We record all episodes in the Beetle Financial Media Studio, made possible by a generous gift from Eric and Elaine Beetle.
So we talked a little bit about how wetlands support mass amounts of biodiversity.
You moved from San Francisco to Indianapolis to save money, surely.
Yeah. That's not the only reason. There's jobs here.
It does help. Yeah, sure. Sorry.
Jobs equal money.
Yes, it's true. So wetlands support a massive amount of biodiversity. They have a huge value in, you know, ecosystem services and what they're able to provide for us, you know, from recreation and everything else. We mentioned earlier, you focus in on mayflies. So, you know, you have this wealth of experience and knowledge when it comes to mayflies. We'll focus mostly on what you're seeing on a very, you know, kind of on the local scales. Like, what are you observing with mayflies in Indiana? And what are some of the conclusions you're drawing from that?
Well, Indiana is the state west of the Appalachians that has the greatest historic mayfly diversity. In other words, As far as we know, more different species, at least once called Indiana home, west of the Appalachians, than any other state in the United States or any province in Canada. And part of that
that's a lot.
Is because we've had some mayfly experts residing in Indiana, and they've looked closely. But it's also due to the fact that Indiana actually has quite a bit of diverse habitats here. We've got Great Lakes in the north. We've got those former massive wetlands also up in northern Indiana. We've got plains throughout the central part of the state. And then you get down to southern Indiana, and you've got hills and the plateaus that have been eroded over the eons by water. You've got glaciated places, northern and central Indiana, and you've got parts of southern Indiana that have never been touched by a glacier. Some of those areas even tie in to the Appalachian and Ozark Highlands. And so we've got a long, long geological history here that has provided a lot of different kinds of water habitats. And as I've been looking through Indiana over the last dozen or so years, it's actually longer than that, probably 25 years, how time flies, but I'm bumpsh.
How time flies, yes. When you look for Mayflies.
You fit right in it with does. The terrible humor that
it
exists
does.
There.
A sigh. But I've been looking for some of the species that were seen in the early days of the study of Indiana waterways. And sadly, about a quarter of the species of mayflies in Indiana have found themselves on our state's threatened and endangered species list. And as a matter of fact, 35 of Indiana's roughly 165 species are on those lists. That's a pretty high percentage. Again, sadly, it's not unique. When I look at other states, look at other countries around the world, typically it's anywhere from about a quarter to even up to 40% of mayfly species fall into those categories. When I look at Indiana specifically, of those 35 threatened and endangered mayfly species, I've only seen 6 of those in the last 10 years. Wow. And I've been out looking really hard with 25 some years experience behind me, and I'm simply not finding those species. And that's kind of depressing.
Yeah, one,
it's very depressing.
It makes me question myself. Am I not doing something right? But
when, you're the mayfly whisperer.
I'm trying, and I am finding things that other people haven't found before, but the number of things that I'm finding that others haven't found is far less than the number of things that I'm not finding. And that's throughout the whole state that I'm seeing this. And it's obviously speaking to some changes in the world around us, and changes not for the better.
Yeah.
Our producer, Kelly, is waving at me frantically because she told me the story of she grew up in Southern Indiana. Guess what? She lived near a lake, not in Lake Town, though.
No, Santa Claus.
Not named where after Santa, a lake. Where Santa comes from, and where the elves live. She remembers
allegedly.
Seeing allegedly.
Obviously, some global warming happening there.
They do. They're slowly migrating somewhere else. I don't know. Now I can't remember the story.
She lived near Santa Claus, and she saw lots of mayflies back in the day.
She used to see lots of mayflies back in the day, indeed, when she was a kid, which is obviously, you know, just 5 years ago,
recent,
Kelly.
Very recent. Very young.
And so clearly, I think lots of our listeners might also have experiences of, similar experiences and somehow getting a sense that mayflies may be in trouble in Indiana. But one thing that I really wanted to ask you about is you're looking for species that we haven't seen in a long time.
Species that we haven't seen in a long time.
Lost things, species.
One could say that.
Why and how are you doing this? Why? Obviously because it's great.
Why?
But
why not?
Why not? And
correct.
Why are any of us doing anything?
This is a philosophical podcast.
But
took a turn.
Are we real or are you just figments of my imagination?
Me being the Mr. Scientist person that I am, and Dr. Professor and all the other wonderful names that people call me.
Mayfly whisperer.
To my face and behind my back. There's a certain level of arrogance that comes with some of that. I mean, we've all got to have some ego to get out of bed in the morning. And to get in front of people and talk about things, you've got to be pretty confident. And I guess it was my ego thinking, well, the reason nobody is seeing these is because nobody has looked. And the right people have not looked, and I am that right person. And I'm going to go out, and I'm going to find all of these things, and I'm going to show how wonderful I am.
I mean, I appreciate that.
And it's been very humbling.
I also appreciate your internal monologue that has a different voice. It's great.
Yeah, lots of voices. Lots of voices, different perspectives. But I thought I could just go out and find these things and then say, ha-ha, look, nobody was looking. That's why we didn't find them. All is well, but that's not what I'm finding. And so I've had to adjust that internal story. Maybe I'm too honest and too vocal about some of those past internal stories, but it's very humbling. And I think it's a good way to help everyone understand what is really happening here. I mean, I'm the person who was joking about a lot of these things in years past. And as I see it up front, in my face, it's hard to deny and hard to say that all is well. Mm-hmm. And when I try to put explanations on it, it's a little bit like that Bob Dylan song about there's something happening here and we don't know what it is.
Yeah.
Can you sing it to us?
I could, but that would be
another podcast. And also, you know,
maybe we could finish this episode with a sing along. It would be nice. Let's think about it.
But you know, as you look for things and you go knocking on the door and nobody's home, you have to wonder why nobody's home. And as I put my feet in the water and look and smell and experience those things, there's a certain amount of degradation that's happening. And that's even happening in some of our forested places and some of our places that we haven't plowed under. Yeah. And that raises bigger questions about why is that happening? And I certainly don't pretend to have all the answers to that, but I see a lot of algae, a lot more algae than I remember as a kid when I went wading in the streams and splashing and picking up rocks and looking underneath to see what was there. And so I wonder about things that have come in that once weren't there, but also as you lose some of the creatures that fed on that algae, is going to build up more. And so there's kind of this vicious cycle going on out in the water.
And it's interesting that, as you mentioned, the like even our protected spaces. So we have this, you know, there's this kind of idealized version that if, you know, if we protect it, it will be there, like that we don't have to worry about that sort of loss. And that even, you know, even as we look at these spaces that we have designated as protected, that we spend time, money, and energy and effort to keep, you know, quote, pristine, that we're still seeing these massive changes.
Right. And there's some challenges with that, because even if, for example, I find a mayfly in a protected space, and I found one this spring and I was over the moon about it, not all of the land that drains the water into that protected space is protected.
Yeah.
And so to protect the species that lives downstream, you have to implement measures to protect the water upstream. That's both the water in the channel and the land that provides the water to those flowing streams. And that's a great challenge.
Yeah. I'm really pleased that you picked up on this, because I was just about to point out, well, protected areas have been established generally with terrestrial areas in mind.
Very true.
Often do not work that well for something that flows through it and is connected to.
And you mentioned earlier with like some of the farmers and some of the practices that we're seeing becoming more popular is that stakeholder engagement, right? It's like generally when we talk about protected areas, there's a community of people, often terrestrially focused people, that are really bought into that. But, you know, these systems are connected to each other, and there's, you know, this huge, huge upstream effect that we don't necessarily think about, because we haven't had that freshwater perspective that is everything's been very focused on, you know, the plants that we're able to see or the animals that we, you know, enjoy. And this, you know, there's a blind spot for freshwaters as well as for invertebrates in many regards.
And this has just come from our mammal coordinator. I've done my job.
You have. So actually, I was going to ask one of the questions that kind of relates to that is, when we talk about conservation, there's so much of it that is focused on these big species. And with my own background, a lot of it was focused on species that weren't even necessarily domestic.
Lions, tigers, and bears.
Lions, tigers, bears, cheetahs. Those sorts of things. And if you ask the average person to talk about endangered species, these are the things we generally talk about, or we talk about whales and their recovery and that sort of stuff. We don't talk about freshwater mussels, and we don't talk about invertebrates. So how do we have these conversations and tell these stories about the conservation needs for these, you know, valuable and in many ways huge parts of our systems, and the threats that they face, and the ways that we can really focus in on making sure that, you know, we don't lose mayflies, and right, that there is a value to having mayflies, even if, you know, a producer Kelly from Santa Claus doesn't know what that is as a small child, but now appreciates it as an adult.
Well, telling stories is something that we all need to be engaged in. And as we all learn and grown our understandings, we need to share that with other people. And almost without exception, I've found that when I start talking to people about what it is I'm doing, what I'm seeing, they get interested in that on some level. And even myself, I grew up from a small child being interested in insects. I was that weird bug kid, and I guess I still am. I never grew out of it, fortunately. And I've always been interested in those things, but I didn't realize what life lived in water. And it wasn't until I started college, actually, and for a class, looked in the water to see what was living there. I always took water for granted because it was there. Sometimes it was in the way, and I didn't even think about it. And that's kind of sad. And so when I went out for this class to collect some insects, I was actually on my parents' farm here in Indiana, and it was just a drainage ditch, something I always thought was kind of ugly and disgusting. I got in there, and I scooped around and pulled up a net, and it was full of life. So this thing that I saw as this unliving kind of nasty thing was full of life. And it was life that I'd never seen before. And for me, again, being someone engaged with nature and engaged with bugs and other creepy, crawly, odd things, seeing all this wonderful new world really excited me. And when I'm out and about, people stop and say, "Hey, what are you doing? Are you catching anything?" And I know what they mean. They wonder if I'm catching any fish. And that provides an opening to talk about what it is I'm doing, and I show them. And again, almost without exception, people are fascinated by this and incredibly interested by this. And yesterday I was out in the field, and I visited one of those places where a certain species of mayfly had been seen 50 some years ago, but nobody has seen it since. So I went back to the site, and as time does, time had changed the space, and there was a bridge with long guardrails there, and there was someone's home there, and it was starting to get built up. And so I had the conundrum, how do I get in there? How do I get into that space and still respect the people and the strong suggestions of keep out that had been placed there? And so I drove up and down the road a little bit. So I'm the creepy guy in the pickup truck driving up and down the road looking out.
I'm sorry to advertise that too much.
No.
We all need a hobby.
We all need hobbies. And obviously I do, because I'm here talking about
bugs. Birding's a good one to keep you out of trouble.
But I drove up and down the road a little bit, and I saw someone out, and I thought, hey, let's do a cold contact. Man. So I pulled up in the drive, jumped out, and I always wear the geekiest t-shirt imaginable
when I go
out and do field work. And so I'm covered in pictures of mosquitoes and moths and all kinds of things. And
in many ways, that then also makes you look really unthreatening.
Yes.
Right? Unthreatening. It's just the geek. He just needed a hobby.
Exactly.
He is lost. I need to help him. I
feel sorry for this child, this man-child who's walking up to my home, obviously lost and needs help finding his way. And so I stop and say, "Hi, I'm Luke Jacobus. I'm a professor of biology. And
professional man-child.
I'm looking for..." I'm going to have to put that on my CV.
Yeah. A professional man-child, yes, I think.
Yes. More on the back of a business
people
card,
should.
At least.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. More now that we've should. Totally lost it. So I walk up and introduce myself again. I tell him I'm a professor of biology, and then I'm doing a study looking for species that people haven't seen for a long time. And lo and behold, one of those species happened to be right here next to your property. And you could see his face just light up. And he was immediately engaged and interested and said, "Oh, sure, you can park right there. If you want, you can drive across my lawn. You can go back there and park, help yourself." And so it always opens doors, again, almost without exception.
Yeah. And now you have a guy who's going to tell an interesting story about the professor that he met and what he's doing.
Exactly.
And who knows where that can take you, where that goes.
Exactly. Precisely. And he also now has an appreciation for what's in his custody, that stream, that land right next to the stream. And he obviously was taking measures to try to make his property look nice and to protect it. And now he's got even more to think about when he's doing that. And that's encouraging to me. And it's getting out there, seeing people, engaging people, and talking to them and listening to them too. And listening to them tell about how the river has changed, how the stream has changed over the years that they've lived there. And you can learn lots of interesting things that way to help me as a biologist, but also to give them context for why it's changing in that way and what things have happened over the course of time.
I love this story. I feel in conservation, at least over the past decade or so, quite often we've been too much focused on the, oh, nobody cares about our little tiny mini species. And I don't think that's true at all. It's just people.
I haven't had that experience, man. Well,
of course, it's like lions and tigers and bears. Oh my. but I really don't think that's true. It's just you can only really care about what you know about. Mm-hmm. And if there's so much stuff out there that we're obviously competing against in terms of information coming in, you just need to tell people what's out there. And people will get engaged.
And I think it's not
people
even
are naturally fascinated with even creepy crawlies.
Yeah.
That's the first wildlife encounters we usually have.
It's true. And there's people. That human connection of, you know, the there's a passion. It's like, I am looking for this mayfly. And, you know, the average person's like, okay, cool. That sounds great. But to have a longer conversation about what the context is, why it's important to you, like why it's important to our system as a whole is one thing, but like why it's important to you is really where that connection point happens. And I think that's a really big, valuable lesson that we see over and over again as we have these conversations, that there's so much about conservation that is the science, that it's the data, and, you know, when evaluating where these species are and what their extinction risks are and that sort of stuff. And we often lose sight of the fact that there's a story behind these, like that there's a reason that people love these species, regardless of what it is, where it's found, you know, what walk of life it is that there's a passion point and that there is somebody out there that loves every type of species.
Yeah, and that's half the reason why I love my job, because I get to work with people who are excited and enthusiastic about stuff that other people will have never even thought about. And I love that. I love that characteristic in people.
And one of really the cool awesome. Things, one of the cool
which
things,
is, which ahead. Is why we love you, Luke, professional man-child and mayfly whisperer.
I never really grew up.
It's great. We can call you Peter Pan as well.
No.
Kelly says no.
No. I have a feeling that's going to get edited out.
I believe that will get edited out.
But one of the great things about mayflies is that even though mayflies fall into what I would call the non-charismatic species group, the not big and fuzzy and the not huge and colorful and the not, oh, wow, immediately to everybody. One of the good things about mayflies is that they live in water, and everyone needs water.
Yeah.
Most of us take it for granted, especially here in the middle of Eastern North America, and we're sitting in this nice, comfortable, air-conditioned room with glasses of clean, cold water right next to us that we sip from and don't even think about. Yeah. The rest of the world is not so lucky, but even if you're among those who take that for granted, it's a very short conversation to help people realize how important water is and how necessary it is. And then to make the connections about, well, if the mayflies are in trouble, if the things living in our water are in trouble, what does that say about our water? And then that opens up conversations about the land that drains that water and about the air that water falls through to get to the land, to get to the streams and lakes and ponds. And it's really a gateway for a wider understanding. And beyond that, I would hope some wider action to do some things to help care for our ecological systems.
This would be generally a really good place to finish this podcast, but we can't let you go until we have blown a tiny little bit of our own trumpet. So, Luke, you have a relationship with the Indianapolis Zoo around your conservation research. This is the trumpet blowing happening right now. How has that project come about, and how's it going?
Well, I have a short-term conservation grant from the Indianapolis, if I can speak. I have a short-term conservation grant. Now I'm going to have to say that again because everybody's going to make fun of me for enunciating.
That's a lot of words, though, isn't it?
Yes, my daughter makes fun of me for saying such things in such ways when she listens to me. So if you're listening, you can make fun of me later.
I was going to say, do kids not generally just laugh at their parents? But I think that's just a normal thing.
I have a short-term conservation grant from the Indianapolis Zoo to study the most endangered and threatened mayflies in Indiana. So a list of about 12 to 15 species that haven't been seen in over 50 years. And I've used that money to travel around the state and revisit some of these places looking for some of these lost species, some very unique habitats, some of which continue to exist, and others I get there and find they no longer exist. And so the zoo is helping me understand the story of mayflies in Indiana better. And by gathering more information, by gathering current information, I can add to that continuing story and share that story with others, as I've done here today.
That's amazing. So look out for Luke and his pickup truck driving up and down the road, coming to a wet space near you.
Yes.
What a way to describe that.
Wet space is probably not the right terminology. Wetland, yes. Water body, to a water body near you.
Yes.
So look out for Luke driving up and down the road in his pickup truck coming to a, what did I just call it?
Body of water. You said water. Wet body, which just doesn't make any sense. It's not better.
I said wet space, admittedly. Kelly is like, please stop talking.
The gestures in this room are definitely noticeable at this point.
But Luke, thanks for joining us today. Thank you for sharing a bit about what you've been doing, what you are doing, and what you hope to do, and sharing some wonderful thoughts about conservation of wetlands and mayflies.
Thank you for having me. Thanks for the invitation. And thank you everyone for listening. And I hope that by learning a little bit more about some of the wonderful, fantastic species that we share our Indiana home with, that you're able to appreciate this wonderful Hoosier State and do your little part to take care of it also.